Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Cesar Romero.
Amos, thank you so much for joining us today on the Ivy Podcast. I am personally excited for this episode to dive deeper into your own background with startups, with tech stars, and also to talk about your book, Levers, and how startups and businesses can use this framework that you speak about in the book to build more repeatability into the business. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you so much, Cesar. I'm looking forward to it as well. And I think we're going to have a super fun conversation.
Yeah.
We'll think so too, but we'll have a good time either way.
We'll have a good time. This will be the most fun time of today.
Best part of the day for sure.
Yeah. So Amos, to kick things off, I wanted to ask you about your upbringing. Being someone that has started businesses, scaled businesses, startups, invested in startups, where does that all come from? Right, when did it start? Right, what were the, I guess, the circumstances that you grew up in that paved the way for you to pursue this as a career path?
Yeah, I have been exploring that a lot myself lately. So it's a little bit of a timely question. I give my founder's story at the beginning of every TechStars program. It's there's a few reasons. It's a way to get to know the founders better, to sort of open up to them and, create, or break down some barriers so they can trust me. And one of the things that I always lead off with was that to this day, I have never thought of myself as an entrepreneur. I don't self-proclaim to be one. I didn't set off on an entrepreneurial path. I didn't go through school saying I was going to start a business or that wasn't the path that I was on. Yet along the way, I've been, either I've started or, been an early employee at six different companies, not including TechStars. I was fairly early at TechStars too. And I don't come from an entrepreneurial family. In fact, I come from I was at both of my parents' college graduations, and they were the first two people in their families to graduate from college. Like, we're third generation born in the Bronx. My parents moved to North Jersey when I was in grammar school to give us a better life. And so getting to more answering your question, I think where it stems from is like I have always had to fight for, or maybe said differently, work really hard to have anything. And I watched my parents move from blue collar to white collar jobs, but like always, sort of never an entrepreneur. Always my dad was at big companies. My mom became a school teacher. And they had to work their ass off. And so one of the things that I know I learned from them was work ethic. Mm-hmm. And I think I ended up on this path simply because for a couple of reasons. One, I don't really like being told what to do. So it's hard to work at a big company. And also just every place that I have been when I've been in a little company, right? The only thing that I know is you need to work really hard and you need to get shit done. I was a wrestler at a very young age. The same thing is something you learn in wrestling, right? You can't hide on a wrestling mat. There's no team around you to support you. It's just you and your opponent. And so you either work really hard and get better or you don't. And I was a little kid. I wrestled at 103 for 4 years, but my freshman year, I weighed 82 pounds. My sophomore year, I weighed 92 pounds. And I was a little kid winning, but fighting my ass off. And I think just put those things together. I don't like answering to anybody and I work really hard and ended up here by accident, totally by accident.
I love it. Yeah, it speaks about, right, what your upbringing shapes in a lot of ways, your frame of reference for life, right? Seeing your parents work hard to provide for you, and your family. Let's talk about that pivotal moment, right? That fork on the road moment where had you gone a different direction, you probably wouldn't have built up a career in startup world, right? What was a pivotal moment for you in your early stage journey, of working in startups, right?
Yeah, I know exactly what it wasn't like a day in time, but it was a short period of time where a few things happened that mm-hmm. set me on this path. I had moved to California after college, and my sole intent was to be a rock climber. Like I planned to work like as little as possible and just travel around and climb rocks. And I had been doing some temp work in New York prior to, I'd gone back and forth a couple of times, but for this company called the Bravo Group. Mm-hmm. Wait, no, I'm going out of order a little bit. So no, I was in California and I was working at a rock climbing gym. So I was teaching rock climbing. I was climbing all the time. And the owner of the gym had a friend who owned a retail shop that sold rock climbing gear. And they needed someone to pack boxes for them. And he worked out of his house. The warehouse was his garage, and it was just on shores. This was my first foray into the startup world. And so I went there to pack boxes for him, sort of same thing. Like I wasn't a stupid kid. I worked really, really hard. I quickly started helping him on the sales floor. The sales floor was the phone. There was no such thing as e-commerce. Literally there wasn't. Like nobody bought anything online.
Right.
And this was sort of like the first foray in the beginning of the answering your question. I was on the phone with a friend of mine from high school who was working in Manhattan and started an interactive ad agency. And I was telling her what I was doing. And she said, well, you should get an URL and sell your stuff online. URL, right? An URL. I'll never forget it because I was like, what is that? But she helped us build an e-commerce site for Shoreline Mountain Products. And it was, I doubt it was the very first e-commerce site, but it was certainly in the first couple of hundred in the world. We didn't know at the time, we weren't thinking of it that way. But, that company sold to a really big outdoor retailer. I wasn't even there for the sale. I left before that. There's sort of a series of events. Like I got my taste in being part of a startup. Mm-hmm. A couple of other things happened in between. And one day I was sitting at a bar doing some more temp work for the company I had done some temp work for on the East Coast, and met this dude who was one of the founders of a company called Hot Jobs. And after, having a couple of beers with him and meeting some of my coworkers, he pulled me aside and said, hey, I'm in this startup and, we're going places and you seem like you'd be really good. Do you want to come work for us? And I did. And that company, hotjobs.com. And that was really the beginning of the ride, but mm-hmm. the taste happened at Shoreline Mountain Products. In my 4.5 years at Hot Jobs, we went public. We sold to Yahoo. I started a whole department there. Like a whole bunch of stuff happened. And then all of a sudden we were inside of Yahoo, inside of this big company. And I looked around, I'm like, I don't like having a boss. So what am I going to go do next? And I went and started a company. But I kind of like in that time frame sort of realized a few things. One, I don't belong in a big company. And two, I like having a lot more control of my own destiny.
I love it. And before that, sales job, had you done sales before?
I hadn't done sales the way that we think about it in like the tech world or the enterprise world. I worked in, retail shops selling jackets and pants, or, I was a waiter several times. So I had sales jobs. I got the experience of like, how do you make more money? Right. I learned early on as a waiter, right. Get them to buy dessert, get them to buy more drinks. Right. So you get bigger tips. But no, I remember I took that role. I had no idea what I was doing at Hot Jobs. And they just basically said, here's a phone. They didn't even give us a list. They're like, here's a phone, figure it out.
Wow.
And I, what I found out later on is I was like 2 days from getting fired because I started with 10 people. I was the last one to make a sale of the 10 people. And my very first sale came in, and that same day I sold to 10 new customers. Like it all just came rushing in. Like I just figured it out just in the nick of time. And then after that, it was, you know, sort of smooth sailing.
I love it. Sales is it's a very important skill. I grew up kind of being a little scared with doing sales, as you know, as we know it, right? the typical sales. But throughout the years, I realized that it's probably one of the most important skill sets that you can develop, right? As a founder, as a individual contributor, as a husband, right? Trying to influence some decisions. So let's fast forward now to Techstars, right? How did that come about? Because the way I understand it is you first became a mentor at Techstars in 2013. And then in 2015, you started as the managing director. So how did that come about?
Yeah. So when I became a mentor at Techstars in Austin, it was Techstars didn't exist here. It was just coming here for the first time, and Jason Seitz was running. He was moving up. He moved up from San Antonio to open the Austin office. I hadn't heard of Techstars before that. I hadn't really heard of the concept of an accelerator before that. And what I got intrigued with was Jason approached me about being an LP in the fund. It was at the time, all the accelerator programs were driven by locally raised funds. And I had just exited a company, Black Locus, and seemed like, like an interesting investment. And by mentoring, I was able to stay close to the investments. I didn't, you know, I really didn't understand what any of it meant at the time, but that was my thinking. Like, yeah, I'll invest a little bit of money. I'll meet all the companies. I'll see how I can help them, you know, return something to us over time. And I really enjoyed the mentoring. And, you know, I think, you know, what Jason told me years later was that I engaged a lot more deeply than most mentors did. Like, I didn't know that I was. I think it goes back to like the work ethic or things my mom said, like, if you're going to do something, like, give it your all, right? My mom, that rings in my head all the time. And so I just went in and I like helped any company who wanted help as much as they needed help. And I was, you know, I had just exited a company. I wasn't working, so I had a lot of time on my hands. And I had a vested interest because I was invested in all these companies as well. And then after Jason ran the program for 3 years, he took a new role inside of Techstars, which is the role he's currently in. And there's a couple of convergence of a couple of things at once. I had started another company in that meantime, and Jason personally invested in that company. Being at it for a few years, I realized that I didn't really believe it was going to be successful. And if it was, it wasn't going to be because of me, and I wanted to go do something else. So I left and I went to have a beer with Jason to essentially tell him that I was leaving. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of hope for returning his capital, which is not an easy conversation to have, as you can imagine. And he responded, this is over a beer, he responded with, "Well, that makes this conversation easier. I need someone to replace me. Will you take my job?" And, you know,
that's great.
Yes, it sounds fucking great. Excuse my language. It sounds great. And, you know, a couple months later, I took over the role. And that was 6.5 years ago.
That's amazing. And there's something about being open to the possibilities and going out for beers that things happen, right?
Yeah.
Because there are times where I've been resistant to attending, let's say, a meetup, an event. But then when I go and I show up, have beers, it's like things open up. It's like things, you just meet people. Maybe you have an intention of meeting someone to talk about, you know, startups, right? Or be a podcast guest, right? You're looking for your next projects, right? And just things happen when you're willing to open up, right? Over meeting people. And it doesn't have to be beer, so it could be coffee, it could be tea, whatever it is. So I'm just glad that you mentioned that a couple of times.
I think, I appreciate that. I think like there's a couple of things. One, I've just learned in my life, all of the things that I have done, I've landed there in a really unconventional way. Everything, like starting at Hot Jobs, the job at Shoreline Mountain Products, starting a company, you know, starting work.com, Black Locus, none of them were conventional ways. And so I think, to your point, just putting yourself out there and being open to opportunities and trusting your gut, I think, is really important. And then the other thing that, you know, I think I've known this and I've operated like this for a really long time, but I'm much more aware of it now in retrospect, and going forward. I've always been really candidly honest and transparent. So not an easy conversation to have, telling someone that, hey, we gave you money and I'm not giving it back to you.
Right.
But it was like the right thing to do, of course, right? Like I didn't, the right thing to do is look the person in the eye and do it, you know, in person. And, you know, I think the lesson there is, you know, being to anyone listening who has investors, who wants to have investors one day, like you, not all of your investors will receive this well, but be really open, honest, and transparent with how things are going all along the way. No surprises, develop relationships. Cause look, he invested money in me, that company failed. He did not get his money back, and I got a job out of it, a great job out of it.
Exactly. It takes courage to be honest, right? But if you lead with honesty and just being upfront, I'm a big believer in that as well.
Yeah.
Now, you know, since 2015, right, you've ran 6 programs and invested in over 9 companies, right?
What 60 through that were in one of my accelerators, and then the others are from Jason's, where I was an LP. But yes, just to clarify the numbers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what's been the biggest, you know, the Amos that started, you know, running the first program versus the Amos that it's going on in 7th program. You know, what's been the biggest difference in terms of growth for you, you know, throughout those experiences?
I have grown and changed so much the last 6.5 years. To say the biggest is going to be hard, but I will try. I think I've gotten a lot more aware of and comfortable with who I am and how I can be impactful and where I can't be impactful, and how to be really open, honest, and transparent with that, with the companies, or with actually in all aspects of my life. And then, you know, as sort of like a general but not specific example of that, and I think when I took this job, I was sort of incorrectly under the impression, like, I really should have all the answers. I should know more than every company. Say it out loud, that's ridiculous. Like, it's not like, but I went in thinking that, right? Which creates, you know, a whole bunch of imposter syndrome, because there's no way that that's possible. And, you know, the thing that it's really helped me learn in a very accelerated way is, where can I provide the most impact? Where are there people better than me? And sometimes, where do I think where's my strong suit? And there's still someone better than me.
Yeah. I love it. It seems like self-awareness has been, you know, one of the biggest growth opportunities for you in terms of your...
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was listening to Jocko Willink. I don't know if you're familiar with Jocko. Mm-hmm. He's a former Navy SEAL. He's written a few books on leadership. And he was talking about the first time he became a leader of a platoon. He had the same thoughts of imposter syndrome, of coming across as someone that had all the answers, but he quickly realized that if he was just coming from a place of honesty and vulnerability and telling his team, hey guys, yes, I'm the lead, but I don't have all the answers. As a matter of fact, I'm gonna be leaning on you to figure this out, right? So it's, you can't possibly have all the answers, right?
You know, I think any great leadership book is gonna say, like, hire people better than you.
Right.
It's a lot easier to say it and read it than it is, you know, I've always, like, rationally subscribe to that notion. Mm-hmm. And when I look back, I wonder if I really did that, or if my own, you know, my own insecurities kept me from hiring someone better than me, or thinking I can't get somebody that I can. And I think, in, you know, sort of in reverse now, as we get ready for the next program, I'm bringing in a bunch of EIRs this year in a way that I never have before. And these are all people that, like, I kind of can't believe that they're willing to come and help me with this in this capacity, because I would work for any one of them any day of the week. They're all incredible people. And but it's that sort of letting that guard down, like, you know, like then remembering the, you know, the mission isn't about me or about them. It's like, we all believe in the common mission. And so, like, how do we go do that in the best way possible?
Exactly. I love how you put that, right? It's not about you. It's about the common mission and getting their buy-in into that mission, right? And how we achieve that together, which essentially that's also a startup, right? Whether it's an incubator or startup. Now, I wanted to shift gears and dive a little bit into your book, Levers, right? And the first question I wanted to ask is, what was the driver for you to put this book into the world? And what was the process like, you know, especially having a co-author, you know, with Trevor?
Yeah. There's a few things I'll say about it. I'll start with it. While, like, Trevor's the official co-author, this book would not have happened without Cody and Troy. Absolutely. They are every much a part of it. Trevor and I just took the brunt of, like, all of the, you know, the hundreds of hours of editing and the minutia. Right. Content is really all four of us. So there's a couple of things that sort of all transpired at the same time. I had written another book called Sell More Faster, which was fun to write and a very different experience. I wrote it by myself. I had a traditional publisher instead of self-publishing it. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of things about that process that were satisfying, and there were some things that were not satisfying. So there was a little bit of that was a driver. And then the other thing, which is probably really maybe the two biggest things, is the stuff that's inside of Levers is all of the stuff that I've been doing at every company I've been a part of, even before I was able to, like, recognize what it was. But when I look back, like, those were the components, and there wasn't an easy framework to, like, wrap them around. So, and not just me, Trevor, Cody, and Troy too, right? And, mm-hmm. and one of the reasons we all clicked around this content, and we clicked around this content years before we even thought of writing a book, was because we all had the same philosophy on, like, how to build a successful business, which was this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the workshops in the book were all workshops that we all independently created for separate parts of our lives. And, you know, one of the things that I did was I brought them all together in my programs and said, like, let's do this. And I started experimenting with, like, what if we, like, we all believe this, we have the content here, like, how do we make this work as a unit? Mm-hmm. And it started to, like, work. Like, we would see it, like, it gave everyone very clear frameworks and directions, and they can see when they were on the right path and off very quickly when they're not on the right path. And so this is post the first book publishing. Trevor and I were working together at TechStars, and he's written a couple of books also. And so I just looked at him one day and was like, what do you think about putting this into a book? And he's like, oh, I don't know how I feel about writing a book. And I'm like, well, hold on a second. Like, what if it was the four of us, right? Like, you and I will take on the brunt of the work to actually get it out there in the world. We'll self-publish it. And so mm-hmm. we can do it on our terms.
Right.
And he's like, huh. So one, the fact that it was four of us made it considerably easier to get done. And, you know, because writing a book is a huge undertaking. I have a lot of friends who've written or are trying to write books. It takes years. And this one, you know, like, we had the content and all in the first draft written in the month, because we just took our piece and wrote the thing that we know really well. We've done 20 years of research on it. So that was one. And then the driver that got us there was when Trevor and I were talking, you know, I was like, this is great stuff. There is nothing like this in the world. There is no series of frameworks that is operationally focused that says, go do it this way, right? You don't have to believe in our process. Don't care if you don't, go find another process. Lots of books talk about the theory behind all of these things. Mm-hmm. None of them give you the tactics. All the greatest books out there, none of them say, go do it in this way. So, like, we're operators. Like, let's just go tell people what to do. And if they don't like it, they don't have to do it. But, like, so that was it. Like, we can impact more people. We can do it. We were able to get it out there in a way that didn't conflict with our other lives in a way that would be detrimental. And we were able to create something that I think we're all really, really proud of.
I love it. And I love especially how it was a team effort, right? Because most books out there is typically it's just one author, right?
Yeah.
Doing all the things, but you guys had your combined brain power to put this out there. And I'm a fan of the book. Haven't read it 100% yet, but it's very practical, right? It just keeps you like step by step. And I feel like you can even, depending on what stage you find yourself in your startup, right? You can go to chapter one or chapter two, right? And make sure, okay, I understand this. Now I'm gonna go apply it and see, you know, what the results are. So with that, from my experience, you know, I've been working in startups for the past 10 years. And one of the biggest things I've noticed is that while conceptually founders or the whole startup team, they might understand the W3 framework, right? Which is the who, the what, and the why. In practice, I've noticed that it's not as easy to figure it out as it might come across. And I wanted to ask you, like, what were some recommendations or things to look out for that can be pitfalls, you know, when trying to implement this W3 framework?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a really great question. And, you know, I'll say, like, everyone has their own way to operate. I haven't always been, but I've become a big practicer of Pareto's principle, which is, you know, get 80% of the way there and
yeah,
and then just get to work and figure out the rest as you go. I think the thing for some people, they like the frameworks because it gives them a really clear direction of what to do. Mm-hmm. And others like it because it gives them like guidance on like things to think about. Right? So before I answer your question, like to your point, any single one of the workshops can be standalone as if the others didn't exist and they're valuable. The mm-hmm. thing that we believe is when you put them together chronologically, they create more value added together, but they're still like, they're all pretty awesome as standalone things to do. So to, you know, answer your question, I think more specifically, which is remember that when you're building your company, there are way more variables and assumptions that are not validated than you can imagine, mm-hmm. that you can really conceive of. And you're going to continually learn about those things. So to think that you have to be really rigid and nail your W3, like I always talk about, like, yeah, you got to go nail your W3 because that's what you're aspiring to. But what you're aspiring to and what you do in practice are not always the same thing. The practice should be getting you directionally towards your aspiration, right? Like, so if you step back and think about that just from like the most fundamental part of starting a business, and we have this in the appendix, so you know you'll get there eventually, which is when you have a vision of your company and a mission for your company, you may never achieve that mission, right? We want to change the world in this way. You may never actually change it, but if you're able to head in that trajectory, you're going to have a really, really massive impact on that. And so use the W3 as guidance. We really believe that this is the right direction to go, and we're going to do everything we can to get there, but there's a whole bunch of things that we just don't know. So to think that we have all the answers is actually will hurt you, right? No, you don't have all the answers, and just get in the right direction.
So that direction over speed, or I guess.
I think there, you know, and Silicon Valley does a lot to really hurt this. And it's one of the things that really frustrates me, which is, oh, you have to go build your company in 2 years. And if you're not at $5 million in revenue after 2 years, like, what have you been doing? That's bullshit. That's straight up bullshit. It takes a really, really long time to build a really like meaningful, sustainable business that provides value. Once in a while, someone gets lucky and it happens faster. The thing that I always tell the companies coming into Techstars is my expectation is this is at least a 10-year relationship from today. I don't care how long you've been in business.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a long time. Take your time, especially in the early days, figure it out, get it right. if someone beats you to the market, it doesn't mean they're going to win. They still have to out execute you. In fact, let them beat you to the market and raise too much money and then go out of business because they spent it in all the wrong places. And you'll continue to build a wonderful, great, long-term sustainable business that is, you know, provides, you know, years and years of wealth to you and your family.
Which is, this is in my philosophy, one of the big reasons why I think startup founders should wait until going to a VC, you know, and getting funding. Because what I've noticed is that a lot of times what ends up happening is they feel pressured by the board, right? By the VCs, by the investors, right? What advice would you have for?
Yeah, we talk about this a little bit in Levers, and I talk about this with all the companies that go through TechStars with me. Ultimately, the founder, the CEO, you're going to pick the path that you believe you want to be on. Mm-hmm. I am an advocate for raising as little money for as long as possible, mm-hmm. and collect as many proof points along the way. So it's not about maintaining ownership. That is one of the byproducts of it. It's about being responsible when you actually go out to raise capital. Mm. And so, you know, a repeat founder with an interesting or great idea may have no problem going out and raising a $10 million pre-seed round and a $40 million valuation. It doesn't mean that person should. It doesn't mean it's the responsible thing to do, right? If there's someone who wants to write that check and that person is willing to take the check, okay.
Right.
That's not how I choose to build businesses. I think we can build lots of really, really big, meaningful businesses by being much more thoughtful and disciplined up front, proving that we have the right to be there, that we know we're in the right direction. And it might take a little bit of capital to get there, but less is more. And I've actually seen more, you don't hear about them very often, but there are more companies that either raise a lot of money and fail, or, and you don't hear about them because the VCs don't want you to know.
Right.
or companies that don't raise a lot of money and are really successful. And you don't hear about them either because those founders typically don't give a shit about being in the news. They just want to deliver value. Mm-hmm. Those two things are real truths that you just don't hear about. So raising a lot of money does not guarantee your success, and not raising money doesn't guarantee your failure by any stretch.
100%, I agree with that. It's ultimately it's about, you know, the business model, and you know, are you serving the customers or the members?
I think it starts with that. Are you serving your customers? Are they getting real value, and are you able to extract from that value they're getting something that will help you build a business that has the right economics to be able to be sustainable and grow?
Now, Amos, can you grow and scale a startup, you know, without revenue? And one of the sections in the book talks about the revenue formula, but I'm curious, you know, from your experience, right, that is this something that I guess you can bypass temporarily as you add more members or get more customers into the funnel, right?
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways to answer that question, and I want to try to answer them at least two different ways. From a pure fundamental perspective, there has to be money, otherwise you can't have the business, right? So if you're not getting it from revenue, you do have to raise. Can you build a business without actually having sales? I would argue it's not a business until there's a financial transaction that takes place. Mm. It may have, like, you may build a company, a product that has millions of users that are highly engaged, mm-hmm. but it isn't yet a business until there's actual money, right? Someone can argue with that definition, but like, right. I don't know how you call it a business if there's not money changing hands. But I do think you can build a product that gets used without having a business model. But it has to get funded from somewhere.
I love that.
And so that's super, one thing.
Super clear.
Yeah. And then I think, though, there's a different question that I don't know that you realize you're asking, or maybe you do, but I want to address it because I think it's really important, because it comes up for me from time to time. And Cody and Trevor actually have a side business where they teach Levers. They teach the process.
That's awesome.
And they sometimes work with nonprofits.
Oh, sweet.
And so what they've developed is, and it's it, it is actually this simple. It's not simple, but it's this simple to explain. Replace the word revenue formula with impact formula. And now, what is the impact? And I think you could do that for a for-profit business too. What is the impact that you're trying to make on your customer? Mm-hmm. Or what is the impact you're trying to make on the world or whoever? And how are you measuring that impact? And then if you're a nonprofit, you're trying to raise money, you now have a metric that says, hey, we said that we're going to, you know, slow climate change. This is probably an awful example, but slow climate change down by 5% a year. Here's the metrics we're tracking to show that we're on the right path. And this is why you should give us more money to Mr. and Mrs. Donor, because we're actually being successful.
I love that. I love that. It's super clear, right? Like, I never heard it, someone explain it like that. So yeah, it's a big difference, right? Product, and I believe that as well. A business, there has to be some monetary transaction, right? To be considered a business.
I think it's exciting for people to say like, oh, I started a business and, but you know, you're not making money. You should have not registered because you've been paying a bunch of franchise taxes for a long time. When it
doesn't I love it. I guess just to close off the delivers segment, and we'll make sure to link it up in the show notes. And also anybody that listens to this episode and message me, you'll get a copy. Well, the first two or three people that message me will give a copy of Levers. But I want to ask you, throughout, you know, Techstars and Incubator, what is the most common, I guess, aspect of Levers that founders get wrong, you know, at the beginning?
I want to change, if you're okay with it, I want to change, if you push back on me, I want to change the word wrong to where are they challenged the most? Because I think the reality is they get everything wrong, but there isn't really a right or wrong, because it's all just theory, right? So if we're doing things that have never been done before, we don't know what we're doing. And for anyone to think that they know, they're lying to themselves. Like, we're figuring stuff out as we go.
I like that. Tell you, what's the most challenging for founders going through the incubator?
I think I'll break it out into philosophical and tactical. Mm-hmm. Tactically, the biggest challenge is to be really disciplined about your W-3 early on. Because
that's a big one.
Because you don't want to limit yourself and you're not sure. And so you want to have optionality. And it takes a lot. For some people, it takes time to realize you have more optionality when you limit yourself, because now you understand what your options are versus collecting a whole bunch of data that you don't know what to do with yet. And you can't make sense of it because you have a lot, but it's not enough to actually do anything with. So that tactically, I think that's the biggest challenge that a lot of founders come up against in and outside of Techstars. I think philosophically, the people will rationally be able to say, I understand why I need to go all through these steps. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, being that disciplined to go through them chronologically is a leap. And even if they say they want to do it, it is outside of how they would normally operate. And so it creates a challenge to say, okay, I believe this is the right structure to use, and I'm going to lean into it, and I'm going to stick to it. Some can do it, but a lot of times. So I'm actually making some changes this year to the way that I deliver it to try to account for that, because I do think philosophically that's a challenge. Like, I don't follow frameworks in general, but I believe this is good. But then, like, I have to change my habits in order to actually be successful at successful at following the steps.
Yeah. That's a big one. And it's something that I've realized over the years, that you might understand something conceptually, but it's not until you change your habits and the daily routines and incorporate that into your daily habits that you're going to see some transformation, right?
So hard to change.
It is hard. I struggle with it too.
Me too. I mean, like... all the time. It is a hard thing to do. You're been a certain way for a certain time. You can be really conscious you want to change it, but it still takes a long time.
It does, you know, which is why when people post on social, I see like, I read 50 books this year. But in the back of my head, I'm always wondering, that's great, but have you applied any of it? You know, I wonder if there's a disconnection, right? Because it's hard. It's hard unless you put it on the calendar and like make a conscious effort to,
yeah.
You know, this will be part of our routine, whether at work or in your personal life. Now, Amos, I wanted to take a step back and kind of do a 10,000 feet view of the Austin entrepreneurial scene or ecosystem, right? And I'm just curious from your perspective, you know, what do you think it's been one of the reasons of seeing the growth and the boom in startups, you know, as it relates to Austin as a city?
Are you from here? Have you been here a long time?
I got here 2017. 17. So yeah, I'm
a couple years, yeah. Pretty I got here in 2008. Although, I mean, I like was trying really hard to not work and do another startup again, which didn't last. So there's a couple of things. One, one of my shortcomings is that I get maniacally focused in tunnel vision and running Techstars. I know everything that's happening around us. And at the same time, like, I kind of don't know everything that's happening around us. So I'm going to try to answer it, but I recognize the shortcoming and I'm trying to solve that with better staff. I think it dates back long before I got here, mm-hmm. 14 or 13 or however many years ago. There's been, I started coming here in 2000 because we opened up an office for Hot Jobs here. And even back then, and even before then, there was a lot of things that both the university and the city was doing, you know, to attract startups, but I would say more so to really focus on creating a thriving economic ecosystem. And, you know, a lot of cities do that. And, you know, I think it's, you know, partially because of, you know, who was in the universities and in local government at the time, and the success of a handful of entrepreneurs that helped, you know, kickstart it, you know, 20 or more years ago, you know, Dell, of course, being one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a whole bunch. And so that's sort of like early on. I think, you know, Josh Baer has done a lot to, you know, very intentionally. I think, you know, he self-proclaimed, he would tell you he's a great marketer. And I think he's done a lot to do a great job in marketing Austin to the rest of the country and the rest of the world, in the work that he's done with Capital Factory. And I think there's, you know, a lot of value in that. And I think, you know, as people that, like, I'll tell you how we got here. And I think that, I don't know if this is true, but I think I'm not alone. Like, I wasn't consciously saying, oh, Austin is where I want to go to build my career. That wasn't our thought process. Our thought process was, I'm from the East Coast. We were living on the West Coast. We wanted a different kind of lifestyle than we were going to get living on the coast. And as we looked around the country, we looked at a lot of different places. We looked at Portland. We looked at Seattle. We looked at Austin. We looked at Boulder. We looked in a couple of places in North Carolina. And we just kept coming back to, like, there's something about Austin that just feels awesome. The weather is great. The culture is great. The people are nice. It's accessible to both coasts really easily. That's what brought us here.
Now, something I'm curious there, and, you know, sorry to interrupt, but I'm curious about this because Austin doesn't have really mountains, right? And you're someone that loves mountains and hiking. How do you make sense of that?
I wish my wife was in the room so that I could answer this and have her kick me one more time. It is the one thing, it is the only thing I don't like about it here. It is a challenge. That is a challenge for me. And I go to the mountains a lot, you know.
Where do you go?
A combination between Colorado, which, you know, Techstars headquarters for a long time was in Boulder, so it's easy to make an excuse to get to Colorado.
Right.
And we have a lot of roots in California, so it's not hard to make excuses to go to California and hit the mountains there as well. So we spend a lot, we do spend a lot of our time when we can in one of those two places.
Yeah. Now on the flip side, right, from your background, right, and we were talking about this before we started recording, you're into music, right? So Austin, in that sense, is a perfect fit, being the capital city, the live music capital, right?
Yeah.
And where this started since early on childhood? Like, where have you always been?
Yeah, I've had a love affair with music for as long as I can remember, but it's come and gone a lot over the years. You know, when I was younger, I played a lot of different instruments. I wouldn't say I was ever good at any of them, but I started on the violin in the third grade. I took drums in the fourth grade. I took saxophone in the fifth and sixth grade. In high school, I played the trombone and the baritone, and then I played the drums, and I took up guitar at that time. And then in college, I played a little guitar. And then it sort of fell away for a long time. And then when I moved here, the very first company I started when I lived here was with a friend of mine from college. It was a music company, which got me back into listening, but not necessarily playing. And then, I have a couple of guitars, and they're always around, and I would like look at them and not really know when to pick them up. And then in the early part of the pandemic, when we realized we were going to be working from home a lot, my wife had the great idea of converting our garage into, well, she said music studio / office. It is a music studio. It is not an office. So I have a little, you can't see it, but I have a recording studio right here and I am playing a lot of music now. I'm playing every day. So hey, I hope it sticks. It comes and goes.
I love it. I grew up with, my father is a musician, but more specifically, he plays the guitar. But man, I never picked it up. I don't know, for some reason, I enjoy music, but I tried it a couple times, but my fingers, I guess, it's just like awkward when I'm trying to play the guitar. But maybe it's in my head. But seeing you, you know,
I'm going to tell you, I think it's in your head. I have a couple of thoughts and some relevant recent experience. I mean, the first is, I do think anyone can learn a musical instrument. I think the thing that some people think is that I don't think very many people have natural talent at it. There are some. It is hard work. It is just hard work. It is digging ditches, right? It's like starting a startup. Learning how to play guitar is actually a really hard instrument because there's things about it that aren't logical. You're moving multiple appendages at once. It just is a lot of work.
Yeah.
That's one. But I'll give you an example. I would have told you for the longest time, if you would have asked me if I could sing, I would say no. But for kind of shits and giggles this year, I decided to challenge myself and I started taking vocal lessons, and it turns out I can sing.
I love it.
I mean, I don't have the courage yet to go do that in public.
Right, right.
But you know, the person is like, you know, that I take lessons from, she's like, no, you have a good voice, right? So I think it just is a matter of like applying yourself, you know, but it is hard.
I gotta stick to it.
You know, and I've heard this, I was just talking to a buddy of mine who's in his mid fifties. I'm in my late forties. He's in his mid fifties. And he would have told you that he has no musical talent at all 5 years ago. We used to sit in these rooms 5 years ago, him, me, and a few other guys, and we'd be playing some music and he'd be there and he wouldn't touch a thing. He's like, I have no musical talent. Well, about 2 years ago, he decided to try the drums. Mm-hmm. And he's retired, so he can put in the time. He has become, in 2 years, because he plays 3-4 hours a day, every single day, he's become quite an exceptional drummer. A great example of how, you know, you really just have to apply yourself. You know, and drums, I mean, holy shit, you've got four appendages doing four different things. You're trying to keep a very specific, like, maybe the hardest instrument there is, you know, and it just is a lot of hard work.
Yeah, I just got to stick to it. Then the first thing I do is make sure I have the guitar ready to go so I can just pick it up and put it back down. Like I said, the less friction there is, the better. Awesome, Amos. To wrap it up, you know, what would be your number one takeaway that you would love to leave the audience, you know, as it relates to starting, whether a business, a startup, or starting project, right?
Yeah, I would say, I might break this. I'm going to try to keep it as one thing, but I think it's going to come out as three. Be really honest with yourself that you're passionate about the thing you're doing, not the notion of being a business owner. Mm. Because if you're not passionate about the thing you're doing, then when things get hard, it's going to be hard to stay focused.
That is so true.
Through it. And recognize up front, two more things. Recognize up front, it is going to be considerably harder than you think it is going to be, just period. And it's going to take a lot longer than you think it's going to be. And you can hear that all day long. But just prepare yourself to spend the next 10 years doing the thing that you're doing. And if you're not comfortable with that notion, don't do it. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing is, don't worry about what everyone is doing around you. People are going to raise money faster or slower. They're going to have sales faster or slower. And it doesn't matter. You're doing something different. You're racing a different race on a different kind of vehicle in a whole different forum, you know. Focus on the things that you can control and learn about the things you can't control so that you can have the best opportunity to be successful.
I love that. And Amos, where can people find you? Best way to reach out to you?
LinkedIn is probably the easiest way to do it.
Perfect. We'll make sure to add the link to the book Levers in the show notes and best way to reach out to you. But yeah, no, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing with us your background, your journey, you know, with startups, diving deeper a little bit into the book Levers. But yeah, I'm excited to put this out there and promote your work, because I think you're doing very important work.
Hey, I really appreciate it. It's very kind of you to say, and I had a great time chatting with you today, man. Really fun.
Thank you, Amos.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.